The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaetis, Judge Connolly, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Theodora K. Gaetis presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have two cases scheduled for argument this morning. The first case is file number 820-0683, Lang Fur Farms, Inc. et al. Versus Bird Island Hawk Creek Mutual Insurance Company. And before we dive into the argument, I see both counsel are here. I just want to give you a couple of ground rules. As everyone knows, we are having this argument this morning via the Zoom platform. Occasionally, technical issues do arise, and if at any point either of the attorneys or any of the judges ends up having a problem with their technology, we'll simply pause the argument and the timer and wait until we're all together again before we resume the argument. Additionally, just so everyone is aware, we are recording this argument. We ask that no one else, and that includes spectators, record the argument this morning. As you can see, we have a timer on the screen that will be keeping track of the attorney's time. Appellant will have 15 minutes to begin, then respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with all of that, I will turn things over to the attorneys. Counsel for the appellant, you may begin, and please do identify yourself before you start your argument.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Adina Bergstrom. I represent the farming appellants, Lang Fur Farms, Lang Family Properties, and the third party defendant in the district court case, Daniel Lang, who is one of the sons that owns the companies. The Langs are third generation farming families. They are mink ranchers. In this case, they are asking that the district court's summary judgment decision be reversed in all regards. The district court's admittedly harsh and unfathomable grant of summary judgment against my clients in finding that they had no insurance coverage for a catastrophic multi-million dollar vandalism claim that they suffered in July of 2018 must be reversed, as must be the finding that the fraud claim, the defense against Mr. Lang personally, be allowed to move forward on the sole issue of whether the respondent insurance company was entitled to an amount of attorney's fees from Mr. Lang personally under an improper expansion of the American rule, which governs in first party insurance claims that each party be required to bear their own attorney's fees.
Ms. Bergstrom, is that second issue actually before us?
The issue as to the third party complaint, Your Honor?
Yes, and the fees, yes.
Your Honor, I believe that it is, and here is why. I know that issue has been raised as to whether or not there is a certified question versus a Rule 54, express a determination made by the district court to make the issues immediately appealable. We do not have a certified question. We have a Rule 54 express determination that there is no just reason for delay. Because of that, the case law supports that all of these issues are immediately appealable and need to be addressed on this appeal. Moreover, it would serve justice to decide this issue as a matter of law. The issue of whether or not there is entitlement to attorney's fees as a matter of law is one that would be properly before this court on de novo review. In this case, in 2018, vandals struck the Lang Fur Farms property. It's located in two locations, one in Eden Valley and one in Richmond. On that particular night, the vandals broke down fences. They released mink from approximately 20,000 cages in 32 buildings. And they introduced a product called Cornerstone into the enclosed water circulation system. That Cornerstone product in the water contained a non-toxic level of the ingredient glyphosate, which has become a focal point of this lawsuit and the district court's decision.
Ms. Bergstrom, you know, I want to make sure I understand it. Are you suggesting that this glyphosate or whatever was put into the water is not a poisonous biological chemical material?
That is absolutely correct in the context of this case, Your Honor, because
how is that possible? I mean, you know, once again, I realize we're in appellate land where anything is possible. But, you know, the testimony I thought from your client indicated that when he started examining this stuff, you know, he had his eyes burned, his pants had holes in them. I mean, that seems a pretty clear indication that whatever was put in the water was, you know, pathogenic or, you know, a poisonous chemical material. I mean, if you drank that stuff, if it burns your pants, it seems to me, you know, it would have dire consequences, just as it had dire consequences on the minks.
Well, I appreciate the court's concern on that point. First and foremost, we have to look at the expert testimony because it goes to an issue of causation. All of the experts in this case, including the veterinary expert, the toxicologists, and the engineers that were hired in the context of this case, all agreed that nothing was poisoned, that the mink were not poisoned. They ended up dying of dehydration because they didn't like the smell within the water. And the toxicology reports came back that it was non-toxic and they had actually died of stress and dehydration. Moreover, the mink are not at issue here. We need to look at the context of how this insurance policy is operating within the facts of this case.
Ms. Bergstrom?
Yes, sir.
I want to follow up on Judge Connolly's, I think, very relevant question. I think you even indicated that this is at the heart of the issue here. And you mentioned the expert reports, but Mr. Lang himself talked about how the water was very acidic in his testimony. And in fact, he said that they found Roundup in the water and the pH was very low. In addition, so you've got that testimony there. In addition, when you look at the PACE analytical laboratory report, it indicates that the pH at 25 degrees Celsius in the system was at 2.1 and at 2. I think either 4 or 5. Water, normal drinking water, is 7.0. You would agree, wouldn't you, that this is extremely acidic solution, correct?
I would agree with you that it certainly threw off the pH of the water. And I'll be honest with you, chemistry was not my strong suit. So it's either basic or it's acidic. So I will follow the court's lead on that issue in terms of it being acidic.
Unfortunately, I have a chemistry degree, so I have just a little bit of background, but I'm going to put that to the side for the moment and just look at the facts in this particular case. But
right,
if something is acidic, nobody is going to drink it. You're like Judge Connolly noted, it burns your eyes, it can burn your clothing, it can burn your hands. So no living thing is going to drink that because of how toxic it would be to you if you would drink it. So doesn't it seem logical that the animals did not drink it and became dehydrated because the water had been contaminated with this poison, with this acid?
I think that, first of all, in terms of where Mr. Lang's concerns came in, his testimony is what it is. He's a layperson, not an expert, but I do understand the court's point. And I do think that we need to look really at the context of this claim in determining how does any type of poisonous chemical come into play in the context of the facts of the case, what's being claimed for damage, and the policy language itself. Those are the three elements we need to look at here.
Right. And when you look at the policy language, how is this, to Judge Connolly's point, how is this acid, this now highly acidic acid, how is that not a poison? How is that not toxic?
Well, first of all, it would have to be in the context of how the damage was caused to the property being claimed. Here we are not talking about the mink. And there is no evidence that the mink were actually poisoned. And I think we need to keep into context too, that the level of the glyphosate is important in terms of what livestock or animals can consume. And that's gonna differ among livestock. And that's a point that even the insurance company adjuster acknowledged. because glyphosate is contained in food products that we all eat every single day. So the
right.
level of that.
And I agree with you that the level certainly matters. When Roundup is sprayed on crops,
exactly.
and that there is a certain amount that of that residue that remains, but it certainly isn't, if that's tested, it certainly isn't at a pH of 2.1, which can cause some serious damage. Water is at 7.0. That's extremely low and exponential. So how can, I don't understand how that can be considered not toxic.
Well, first of all, it comes down to, again, we're looking at the property, which is an enclosed mechanical watering system.
That the mink drink the water from, correct?
Correct. Yeah, it's an enclosed circulating system. They're required to have it under the humane certification specifications for this particular type of farming. Now, that system was not poisoned. In fact, the defense, the respondent, did not meet their burden of proof of even showing that anything was poisoned because with respect to the watering system, because their expert, Crane Engineering, opined that, frankly, the vandalism didn't cause any damage to the system, period.
But isn't that contrary to the position that you take in your brief on page 34? You talk about how the watering system had been physically damaged, meaning the seals and nipples dried out and leaked system-wide, because the pH of the water changed. And then you next state that is not a poison-related injury, but you do acknowledge that the pH of the water changed. It became extremely acidic, which damaged those seals and nipples.
Correct.
And that same pH change is one that prevented the minks from drinking the water. So how is that water not poisoned?
So first of all, as to your second point, the reason why the mink didn't drink the water, number one, that would be speculation. The experts in this particular case opined that in any type of off smell in the water, the mink won't drink it. If you mixed Mountain Dew in the water, they wouldn't drink it because they don't like the smell. So it's not necessarily an issue of poison, and there's nothing in the record that would indicate that. In fact, to the contrary. In terms of the damage to the mechanical system, no one has tied that back to the actual poison, to the glyphosate. It is a one component, and there are the vast majority of the ingredients in the cornerstone are inert ingredients. Very simply put, there are many liquids that are acidic. You can drop a penny into a pile of Coke and that will corrode it and it will eat away at it.
That's right, but Coca-Cola is not at the acidity of 2.1.
Correct. And the levels did not remain there. As the water flushed in over time, they dissipated. And I think that it can't be ignored in this position, in this particular case, that the seals were not poisoned. They were simply dried out. And if you start redlining language in the exclusion, that would be contrary to Minnesota law. If the exclusion had said any chemical or had been as expansive as the definition of pollutants or contaminants, that would be a different case. This exclusion is expressly tied to the adjective poisonous, and to state or to decide that all of a sudden that poisonous property is somehow not required in the harm that results would be to leave that particular language meaningless. And that's contrary to Minnesota law. We need to apply how the insurer actually wrote the policy, meaning that if it's clear, then you require that poisonous adjective be applied in terms of how the damage manifested itself. It's got to be a poisonous damage. Secondly, if there is ambiguity, and I would submit to this court that the respondent did not show that there was one reasonable definition of this term, because poisonous can mean one drop of anything poisonous, all of a sudden you vitiated coverage, which I think is an absurd result, considering that most arsons involve things that are poisonous, but they're not the damaging factor. And that's
right. I want to stop you right there, because when I'm looking at the chemical or biological exclusion, it says, regardless of the amount of damage or loss. You've been focusing on the damage, but the clear language says that it applies regardless of the amount of damage.
Correct, but it doesn't say regardless of how the damage is caused. I still believe that there needs to be a causal factor between the poisonous property of that chemical and the damage that manifests. Otherwise, any chemical would apply. And I, again, Your Honor.
Ms. Bergstrom, I'd like to follow up on a statement that you made.
Yes.
And I certainly agree we should apply the language of the policy. What is your best argument or case that the anti-concurrent cause exclusion, which seems to be in the policy, does not apply here?
I think, first of all, you have to get past this issue of but-for cause of the loss, Your Honor. You know, as Your Honor acknowledged in the decision.
Why? I mean, if.
Sure.
You know, applying common sense, it seems like vandals, and, you know, I know there's a dispute as to who killed the minks, but, you know, if vandals put something bad into the system, then, you know, vandals and whatever they poured in the system is a problem. Concurrent causes. Now, it seems to me, while Minnesota doesn't, the Eighth Circuit has commented on, you know, the concurrent cause language and policies, but it's clear to me that you can have an exclusion, you can have an anti-concurrent clause, which they're saying applies here. Why shouldn't we apply that based on the plain language of the policy?
I mean, first of all, my clients reasonably expected that they would have vandalism coverage for vandalism damages.
Which right, is, but the problem with that is, I mean, I understand the reasonable expectation doctrine comes in if a policy is ambiguous, but if the anti-concurrent clause exclusion is not ambiguous, then they could not reasonably expect to have coverage. So why am I wrong? I would ask Judge Gaetis to give me, allow the Ms. Bergstrom to answer my question, please.
I will, and Ms. Bergstrom, you may answer.
Thank you very much. And at the extreme caution of telling Your Honor that you're wrong, I would direct you to General-
Please do, people do it all the time.
I would direct you to General Mills versus Gold Medal Insurance. That citation is 622. Northwest 2nd 147.
It's a right, but that yeah. I thought that, which I have in front of me.
Yes.
Did not that case depend on whether there was ambiguity in the contract?
It was twofold. So the court did find that it was ambiguous because it did not specifically refer back to the excluded peril. But I believe that it's very much on point here because the holding in that case is where a non-excluded peril creates another peril that is excluded, then the resulting damage is still covered. And that's exactly what we have happening here. So the court did find that it was ambiguous for similar reasons as we have argued in our brief, meaning there is no tie back to the vandalism coverage. The vandalism coverage in the policy speaks to vacancy and it speaks to other reasons why. When you get to that concurrent causation exclusion, there's no tie back. And the court is very clear in General Mills that that's required. And you can see that when you can compare it to cases like the Koskovich case or to Ken Johnson Properties. When you look at the disparity between those decisions, that ambiguity is very clear. And then I'll finish, because there is more than one reasonable interpretation here, that needs to be construed in favor of coverage. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument, Ms. Bergstrom. We will next hear from the attorney representing the respondent. You may proceed with 15 minutes. And Mr. Simpson, you're on mute.
So much for a snappy beginning. May it please the court, my name is Greg Simpson. Blake DeRozier and I represent Bird Island Hawk Creek Mutual Insurance Company. We're the respondents in this case. Representatives of my client, Bird Island Hawk Creek, are in attendance, I believe.
So I can safely assume Mr. DeRozier did most of the work on this brief then.
Everything that's good about it, he did. All the mistakes are mine, Your Honor. I understand. So I should probably begin with the end. Judge Connolly, I don't want to run out of time and miss the rule, appellate rule 103 issue. So I don't think that the fraud issues are properly on appeal. This was certified by Judge Scherer only on the coverage issue. And so none of the other issues have been fully fleshed out in the district court, and I don't think they're properly on appeal, but we did address the merits of those issues as well. So to the extent that you do reach the merits of those other fraud-based issues, we have put information in our briefs that address the merits of them as well. And now if I run out of time, at least I'll be talking about the main issue in the case, which is the coverage question. Judge Scherer did not err by granting summary judgment to Bird Island Hawk Creek on the basis of the policy's chemical and biological exclusion. The and I always have to refer to the exclusion itself. And one test of whether somebody has got a good position on coverage is whether they want to talk about the policy or if they want to talk about cases construing different policies. And you've heard a lot of talk about cases construing different policies, and particularly the gold medal case is an example, a much less robust and much more confusing concurrent causation clause in that case. We have a very robust anti-concurrent causation clause in our policy, which there's really no two ways about it. There's not really a credible, I couldn't really understand what was ambiguous according to the appellant's brief about the concurrent causation clause. So the facts, and I don't want to dwell on the facts, and it sounds like everyone is well up on the facts, but it is important to know that Bird Island Hawk Creek is a mutual insurance company, township mutual insurance company. It's a statutory form of insurance. It's as old as the state itself. And footnote one in our brief explains exactly what type of an entity or what type of an animal a township mutual is. So this policy is what is called a combination policy. It basically, these township mutuals like Bird Island Hawk Creek team up with what's called a statewide insurance company, which in this case it's Grinnell, and they issue a policy that's really two or three policies in one. It covers, you know, the basic perils of farming, and it also creates an all-risk policy by, I would call it, gap filling. Grinnell comes in and fills in the gaps to turn this policy into kind of an all-risk policy. And there's also a dwelling policy attached to it really as well. And the reason I mention that is because in connection with the her argument that this policy is confusing, counsel talks about how big it is and how many pages there is, but really we're only talking about the TP1 form. Everything that we need to talk about is in a 30-page form, which is called the TP1 form, and it's a commonly used form by township mutuals.
Mr. Simpson, why should an insured why should whether a vandalism coverage in a policy depend on what type of materials vandals use to destroy your property? Getting to Ms. Bergstrom's reasonable expectations, and I will just say, you know, I was not a chemist like Judge Reyes, so I thought it was a long policy, and I did have some worried about reading everything unlikely or entirely. But I mean, why should coverage depend on what type of, you know, whether they're just ordinary vandals who just throw rocks at your animals or really smart vandals who poison your water system? Why should the coverage depend on what instruments of vandalism the vandals use?
Well, there's two answers. One would be an underwriting question that I don't have, you know, I'm not an underwriter, so I don't know exactly why, but I would imagine that the risk is so great and it's within the control, it's deemed to be within the control of the policyholder such that underwriters don't want to accept a risk that somebody could just dump one bottle of Cornerstone or maybe more, we don't know exactly how much, into a watering system and cause so much damage, multi-million dollar damage. The premium charged on this policy is not proportionate to that type of risk. And that's really the basis. I mean, you could ask the same question of any—
Does the record indicate what was the premium on this policy for a year?
Well, I think it's in there. It may have been redacted, but certainly the parties have that information. It would be somewhere in the early pages of Exhibit C to my declaration. So
is your argument basically that, well, the exclusion is what the exclusion is, and if they wanted to cover vandalism by, you know, a nuclear bomb, they could have paid a higher premium? I mean, is that sort of the bottom line?
Absolutely. It's not harsh, because there are tons of exclusions in the policy, and if the marketplace of insurance determines what people will pay for a policy, and it's a balance between what insurance companies are willing to insure and what policyholders are willing to pay as a reasonable premium for the quality of insurance that they get and the things that are covered. And this is, you know, so there's, it's a give and take. And this policy is from the TP1, it looks like it's been around since 2013 or 2011. So it's been around for a while since the last revision of it. And it's created by Township Mutuals, by an association. And it's a commonly used form. Everyone understands, everyone outside of, you know, who deals with commercial, with farms, understands what's in this policy. So I was giving you the underwriting answer. There's also the policy, the textual answer is the reason why it matters is because the policy says it matters, and there's no ambiguity in the policy. So we don't really have to get into the underwriting questions as to why the policy is written the way it is.
Well, Mr. Simpson, I think the district court certainly thought that the result was harsh and really, I think, took pains to say, well, my hands are tied as a district court, but if an appellate court wants to reverse, that I would have no problem with that whatsoever, given the harsh result that we have here. But I want to focus on the concurrent causation clause, and in particular, my question to you is with respect to the Supreme Court decision in Fawcett House. And I'm curious as to why that case does not apply here, because that was a vandalism case that was one where they had a general exclusion for a change in temperature. And that seems to go to the causation issue, which is kind of my second question of what evidence really is there of the causation linking the glyphosate to the damage that occurred here? So the first question is, why doesn't that Supreme Court case of Fawcett House apply? And what is the evidence in the record of the causal link?
The Fawcett House case did not involve a concurrent causation, an anti-concurrent causation clause. There was no clause analogous to what we're dealing with in our policy. So it was just a kind of an old school type of insurance policy back in the days before insurance companies got wise to these arguments and started putting anti-concurrent causation clauses. Because every court to say, well, if the insurance companies, you know, want to be clear about this, they can put in policy language that makes it clear. And Fawcett House is based on ambiguity. The court says that it's ambiguous whether the policy intends to cover, I believe it was vandalism. So the sequence of events in that case was an act of vandalism, took out the heating system, the temperature then dropped, the pipes froze and burst and caused all the damage. And so there was an argument that, well, it really wasn't the change in temperature, because the policy excluded damages resulting from changes in temperature. And that was in a general exclusion. And the court said, well, it's, you know, there was the first cause was the vandalism. And that may, or, you know, depending on what the weather was, that may or may not have caused the second event. So really, it was the first event that was the prominent efficient cause or whatever. And then policy, it really depended on ambiguity. If you read the decision, I'm sure you have, that's the basis for it, is that there's some ambiguity as to what, you know, whether the general exclusion was intended to apply where there was an initiating cause that was clearly a covered peril.
But the case did certainly talk about the causation issue with respect to the vandalism, and that it really did not directly cause the damage. And so that seems relevant to the issue that we have here. So focusing on that causation link, where is that here? What is the evidence tying everything together?
And here's where I go back to the policy language, because it doesn't really have a causation requirement in it other than this. It says, as you pointed out, regardless of the amount of damage or loss, this exclusion applies to any losses that are carried out or caused by dispersal or application of pathogenic or poisonous biological or chemical material. So it can be either carried out or caused by the dispersal of those chemicals. So here we have a loss that there's really no dispute. And bringing this all back to the Rule 56 standard, there is no dispute that the bad thing that happened, the loss, was a result of these unknown vandals putting chemicals, cornerstone with glyphosate and acid, into the well in one location and into the holding tank in the other location. And then it dispersed throughout the entire farm to the 30,000 individual cages where the minks either did or didn't drink it. I don't think that's even relevant. So your focus is on the causation. The damage doesn't have to come from contact with the chemical. It has to come from the dispersal of the chemical. It has to be carried out by dispersal of the chemical. And there's no other way to describe what happened. If you were trying to describe what happened, you would say, well, this loss was carried out by dispersal of a chemical, a poisonous chemical. And as to whether it's poisonous or not, counsel conflates the issue of toxicity with poisonousness or the being a poison. It's a broadleaf killer. It's an herbicide. It kills organic things. That's what glyphosate does, whether it's cornerstone or Roundup. That's what it does. If you don't need an expert to tell you, you might need an expert to tell you what concentrations are toxic, but you don't need an expert to tell you that the nature of this product is that it's a poison. It says it right on the label. It will kill broadleaf, weeds. So your question, I think you wanted to focus in on don't we have to look at the kind of the molecular interaction? And now that I know that you're a chemist, that's why you're clearly interested in how this chemical interacted with the mink or with the components of the watering system to create the damage that resulted. And the allegations, these are the Lang's allegations, are that the glyphosate stuck to the scale on the inside of the pipes and that it's kind of leaching into the water supply, and it gives it's either toxic to the mink or the mink won't drink it depending on what day it is. What court they're in front of, they will take a different position, whether in their depositions, in their EUOs, in front of the Judge Grunke on the motion to dismiss, in front of Judge Shearer on the motion for summary judgment, and now in front of you, the position shifts from day to day. But what they're saying is that this glyphosate material, the cornerstone, stuck to the inside of the pipes, it leaches out, and the only way to fix it is to destroy the entire system and put in a new one. Now, we take issue with that as a question of damages. That issue's not in front of you, but that's the mechanism by which the damage is alleged to have occurred. So we think, again, bringing it back to the language in the policy, which is what we have to do here, was the loss carried out or caused by dispersal of a pathogenic or poisonous biological or chemical material? Yes. Is it carried out by or caused by? Check. Is it a pathogenic or poisonous material? Check. Is it biological or chemical? Yes, it's a chemical. So it you check all the boxes. And
on the last one, the last box is disperse, which is not defined in the policy. So are you saying we should follow the Eighth Circuit's approach in restaurant recycling and simply use kind of the plain and ordinary meaning of dispersal?
That's right. That's exactly right. And Judge Scherer did that. He quoted some dictionary definitions. We've quoted dictionary definitions. That's what you have to do. And there's really no, if you were trying to describe, come up with a verb that describes chemicals being placed in a confined, tank with a well or the holding tank, and then going through a series of supply pipes. And I'd refer you to one of the photos that shows how the, where the water is in the pump house, and then it goes to these 30,000 individual mink cages, but progressively smaller pipes until it reaches the nipples in each mink cage, and then the minks, drink from it in each cage. That's, you can't come up with a better verb than dispersal for that, to describe that process of, a concentrated chemical becoming progressively less concentrated as it disperses throughout a system. That's exactly what happened.
And your time is up, Mr. Simpson. Thank you for your argument. We will now turn back to Ms. Bergstrom. You will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. And there we go. The clock is now ready for you. You may begin.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. To pick up where respondent has left off, simply because something is toxic, fully concentrated in a bottle, does not mean that it is toxic in its very highly diluted form, which is exactly what we have in this particular case. It's axiomatic under Minnesota law that insurance coverage has to be applied to the actual facts of the case. And those facts, including the expert opinions, which followed the Rule 12 motion that was brought by the respondent in this case, and discovery can't be ignored. That's the purpose why we have discovery and we have expert reports and have them drawing conclusions, because certainly the Langs are not chemists. They are not engineers. They are not veterinarians. They're farmers. And so we need to keep those statements within the context. What we have here is a situation where non-toxic, which under the dictionary definition is synonymous with not being poisonous, has dried out seals. It is no different than if some other mechanism were used to dry out the seals of this mechanical system. As to the issue of dispersal, while there is certainly the argument that respondent is making that any plain old dictionary definition of dispersal should apply, we have the Sylvester Brothers development case where in a court decided differently and they limited that definition to not include chemicals or materials that are added to a confined system. And at the Rule 12 hearing, and this isn't a position that the respondent has changed, they have not changed this, the mechanical system is a confined system. So by as a matter of law, by judicial notice, we got two different definitions. Therefore, as a matter of law, that definition is ambiguous and must be construed in favor of coverage, with this court following the Sylvester Brothers development decision.
Ms. Bergstrom, on that point, when, and I think all the parties agree that dispersal is not defined in the agreement at all. So typically what we do at that point is then we look to the common use of it. In other words, the dictionary definition. And when we do that, we generally look to Merriam-Webster's dictionary. And that dictionary definition talks about dispersal, meaning that you distribute it more or less evenly throughout a medium. And this system that we have here, this water system, drinking water system for the Minks, that is a medium. I don't see how that doesn't qualify under that definition.
Your Honor, I think that the whole point is there is more than one reasonable definition, and therefore it is ambiguous. And
even the definition that you use of a closed system, this is a closed system as well. So I don't see how the two definitions are in conflict with each other.
So in the Sylvester Brothers development case, Your Honor, the court said you do not have legal dispersal under an insurance policy's exclusion. Where the, in that case, it was a pollutant, was introduced into a confined system. It's more apt for when a material of that nature is released into an open area. For example, in the agricultural industry, crop dusting. When you've got crop dusters coming over and dispersing into a wide open area, these types of chemicals. And we also have to remember that in the insurance law context, we need to look at the intent of the coverage, which leads us back to the fact that we have vandalism coverage. Without the vandals, we don't have any of this damage.
Right, but the fact scenario that you have there is a very, very different fact scenario than what we have here. In terms of when you're talking about crop dusting and oftentimes sure. those types of cases are one where the crop that is put on one farm or one area, it ends up crossing over and contaminating another. So that's a very, very different system that you have there. Certainly. So that definition of that's a very different scenario than what we have here.
I agree with you. And the one that's most closely analogous is the Sylvester Brothers case, where you have materials being introduced into a confined system, not into an open area, such as the other cases that respondent has cited. You have a confined system and therefore it doesn't qualify in the insurance context as dispersal. I would also like to quickly address the fact that we do have a harsh result in this case. We do have a situation that is very closely analogous to the Atwater case, leading to the reasonable expectations doctrine and its application herein. I notice that my time is up. May I conclude, Judge?
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The appellants respectfully request that on this court's de novo review of the summary judgment decision rendered by Judge Scheer, that it heeds Judge Scheer's request that these exclusions be reined in and that the harsh result be reversed, because it is unfathomable that farmers such as the Langs would be denied insurance coverage for the vandalism damages that they clearly suffered on July 17th, 2017. For that reason, the summary judgment should be reversed in its entirety, the counterclaims dismissed, and the third party complaint against Mr. Lang also dismissed as overreaching and unduly expanding the American rule. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel. The case was very well argued and is now submitted to the court. We will be issuing our opinion within the next 90 days.